From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, Israel holds funerals for three murdered teenagers as the state's military pounds the Gaza Strip with dozens of airstrikes.
If they didn't respond to the murder of three teenagers, it would only encourage Hamas and others to do it more. It would be a little bit like asking us, the U.S., to be restrained in our response to the terrorist attack on us on 9/11.
Also today, the European Court of Human Rights uphold France's ban on Muslim women wearing the face veil. And British comedy legends Monty Python reunite for the first time in 30 years.
Spam, 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 egg and spam. Spam, 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 spam. Baked beans, spam, spam, spam and spam.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Three Israeli teenagers found dead in the West Bank have been buried at a ceremony attended by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He's vowing to take reprisals against the Palestinian organization Hamas, which he blames for the deaths of the three boys. Hamas denies any culpability in the teenagers' disappearance. Israel launched airstrikes on the Gaza Strip following the recovery of the boys' bodies. Journalist and activist Ben White says the death of the boys has inflamed Israeli public opinion.
The Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is hearing calls from members of his own cabinet and from the Israeli public for revenge, but also is balancing that up against certainly a desire not to sort of initiate a larger scale escalation.
Palestinian lawmaker Mustafa Barghouti is critical of the Israeli government's response.
The Israeli army or the government could not provide any single proof of the responsibility of anybody for this death. But if we talk about the overall cause of the death, whether we are talking about the death of Palestinians or Israelis, it is definitely the continuation of military occupation.
A big court ruling in Europe. The European Court of Human Rights has upheld a French law that bans Muslim women from wearing a full face veil. From FSN's Europe desk in Brussels, Jack Parrock has more.
The case was originally brought to the European Court of Human Rights in 2011 by a 24-year-old woman who says wearing the niqab is part of her religious freedom. But the case has been dismissed by the court in Strasbourg, and there is now no possibility to appeal. France imposed the ban on full face veils in 2010 under Conservative President Nicolas Sarkozy as an affront to French secular values. And it will now remain imposed on the 2,000 women who wear the niqab there.
The former French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, was detained for questioning on Tuesday over alleged influence peddling. It's an unprecedented legal move against a former French head of state. He was questioned by magistrates near Paris. Iraq's new parliament ended its first session in disarray. Lawmakers failed to make any progress choosing the country's new leadership. The president of Iraqi Kurdistan, Masoud Barzani, told the BBC he's planning to hold a referendum on independence later this year. FSN's Ollie Barrett is on special assignment in Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan.
Clashes continue between Iraqi government forces and IS or ISIS militants across swathes of the north and west of the country. Here in Kurdistan, the situation is much more stable, and that is one of the reasons why the Kurds are getting stronger and stronger in their calls and their posturing around the idea of independence.
The United Nations estimates nearly 2,500 people have been killed in the last 3 weeks of fighting in Iraq. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Police in Britain say they may launch fresh legal proceedings against disgraced children's entertainer Rolf Harris after his conviction on 12 charges of indecent assault. Scotland Yard says a number of additional women have come forward in the aftermath of the court's verdict, and their claims are now being reviewed by police. Peter Wanless, the chief executive of Britain's National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, says calls to its helpline have increased dramatically in the hours since Rolf Harris's conviction.
In the last 24 hours or so, contacts to that helpline are up by about a third. Not specifically about Rolf Harris, though a few people have mentioned him, but I think there is a genuine desire now and an increased confidence to speak up and speak out about sexual assault.
And Rolf Harris will be sentenced on Friday. The president of Uruguay is accusing soccer's world governing body FIFA of imposing fascist sanctions on Luis Suarez, the player who was banned after biting an Italian during a World Cup match. FSN Espanol's Andrea Areñas reports.
The 79-year-old Uruguayan president harshly criticized FIFA officials as he received the Uruguayan team home from Brazil at Montevideo Airport. He admitted that Suarez deserved to be disciplined, but said his suspension was too harsh. They could have punished him, but not with fascist sanctions, added President Mujica, defending Luis Suarez, who has been banned twice in the past for biting other players. The Uruguay Football Federation has already informed FIFA that it will appeal against Suarez's ban. Player Luis Suarez has since apologized to Italian player Giorgio Chiellini via Twitter, who replied by saying that all is forgotten and that he hopes FIFA reduces his ban. Andrea Arenas, Washington.
For more news, listen to FSN Reports at featurestory.com or on Stitcher. And that is the latest feature story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Mourners at the West Bank today as funerals were held for three murdered teenagers found buried under rocks near the town of Halhul. Just hours after their bodies were discovered in the West Bank, Israel carried out over 30 airstrikes against targets in the Gaza Strip. Israel has blamed Hamas for the kidnap and murder of the teenagers, an accusation the Palestinian militant group denies. Ben White is the author of Israeli Apartheid, a beginner's guide.
I mean, the events of the last few days and weeks sort of represent another grim chapter in Israel's ongoing occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Like you said, we got the confirmation yesterday that those three missing Israeli youths had been killed. Overnight, in fact, woke up this morning to see that Israeli forces raiding Jenin, Palestinian city in the West Bank, had shot dead a 16-year-old Palestinian, and that's the sixth Palestinian to be killed by the Israeli army since the 12th of June, and there'd also been dozens of Israeli airstrikes on the Gaza Strip, which actually was specifically in response to rocket fire over the last few days, as opposed to the killing of the teens. But yeah, this is a moment where the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is hearing calls from members of his own cabinet and from the Israeli public for revenge. But also is balancing that up against certainly a desire not to initiate a larger scale escalation with Palestinian groups like Hamas. And all of this coming in the context of a comatosed peace process where there's no genuine negotiations taking place. And in that sort of vacuum, it's exactly the sort of the violence and confrontations that we've seen recently. In that sort of vacuum is where they take place. I mean, even during the peace process, Israeli forces had killed over 70 Palestinians since last summer in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. But certainly these days are days when there is the potential for more.
Ben White, author of Israeli Apartheid, A Beginner's Guide, speaking to LBC Radio's Lisa Aziz. This is FSN Reports. The leader of ISIS rebels in Syria and Iraq has called for Muslims worldwide to travel to the Islamic State he says he is forming in the region. The new audio recording from Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi comes as politicians in the Iraqi capital fail to make progress on forming a new government. Meanwhile, the White House has repeated its calls to Baghdad to ramp up efforts to unify the country in the face of that growing militant threat. President Obama has dispatched almost 1,000 US troops to Iraq to help secure the US embassy and advise Iraqi security forces. And as US military jets continue flying surveillance missions over Iraq, the Obama administration has not ruled out the use of airstrikes or armed drones. Our correspondent Ollie Barrett is in northern Iraq.
Many observers of Iraqi politics would say that what took place in the Iraqi parliament was entirely predictable. Nouri al-Maliki insists he has the right to try and put together his own government, given the results of elections in April. But the Sunnis and the Kurds have for a long time felt excluded by his government in Iraq. And so the collapse, really, of any sense of order in the Iraqi parliament as politicians got together to try and discuss forming a new government, as I say, surprises very few, but it clearly has worrying implications, given that, for example, any extra US support in fighting ISIS rebels seems to be contingent on a new Iraqi government being formed.
And, Ollie, it seems a push for Kurdish independence from Iraq, those calls are growing louder, And that move is gaining momentum amid this crisis.
Statements on independence from Kurdish leaders seem to be getting stronger and stronger now. It is pretty clear from Barzani's words that a referendum on independence will take place in the not too distant future. Much of Kurdistan remains very safe, very secure. The Kurds feel that they have tried to make Iraq work, but that now this crisis has shown that it may be time to go it alone. They also have more power and potentially more economic strength than they did only a few weeks ago, given that they seem to have taken control of what used to be the disputed city of Kirkuk, the oil-rich city of Kirkuk.
And Ollie, we know that ISIS declared that Islamic State in the region, but where are we in terms of their current offensive?
Clashes continue between Iraqi government forces and IS or ISIS militants across swathes of the north and west of the country. Here in Kurdistan, the situation is much more stable, and that is one of the reasons why the Kurds are getting stronger and stronger in their calls and their posturing around the idea of independence. The Kurds insist they have tried very hard to make Iraq work, but President Barzani essentially saying that Iraq is already partitioned. The US, the UK, the West oppose outwardly the idea of Kurdish independence, the US and the UK notably having led the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Ollie Barrett in northern Iraq. Now, the European Court of Human Rights has upheld France's law banning Muslim women from wearing the full face veil. The French law states anyone wearing clothing which hides the face in a public space can be fined the equivalent of $200. The law was introduced during the presidency of Nicolas Sarkozy, who today, in an unprecedented move, was held in police custody and questioned over an investigation linked to financing for his 2007 presidential campaign. I discussed Mr. Sarkozy's situation with our Brussels correspondent Sandra Gatman, but began by asking her about the impact of today's ruling over the face veil.
It puts an end to the prospect that this ban on the niqab could be overturned somehow by a higher court. But of course, now there's no possibility to appeal the decision any further. And of course, what it does is prop up the laws not only passed in France, but also in Belgium, where the veil ban was introduced several months after France did. And so the rules still stand. Women are still not allowed to wear the full veil in public spaces and will be continued to be fined by judges in France after being approached by police if found wearing them. Now, the court did shoot down, though, some of France's arguments for passing this law that the full veil ban was legitimate in the interest of public safety reasons, to be able to identify people on the streets. But it did say that the full veil was not conducive for social cohesion and, of course, upheld the law on those grounds. But I do suspect that criticism of the law by human rights groups and those that believe the full veil ban is in breach of freedom of expression will continue.
So, Sandra, has today's decision been met with much criticism in Europe and obviously in France in particular?
Well, this particular case was brought forward to the European Court of Human Rights by a young French Muslim woman, and her lawyer said she was, of course, disappointed but that she would respect the Strasbourg court's decision as she has done up till now. There's been disappointment too, though, from other human rights groups. One organization in France, which advocates for Muslim rights, said that contrary to what the court ruled about the veil ban helping social cohesion, the law will in fact perhaps exacerbate social tensions in France, because while only a very small minority wear the full veil in France, the country's more than 5 million Muslims might be subject to citizen scrutiny, even if just wearing the headscarf, for instance. Now, on the other hand, we had the French government today applaud the decision, and a spokesman for the foreign ministry said the decision in Strasbourg reflected France's commitment to gender equality.
And of course, this law was actually introduced under former President Nicolas Sarkozy, who has been making some headlines himself today.
Well, Mr. Sarkozy is still under questioning, and meanwhile, the country remains under shock. This is, of course, an unprecedented move in France. No former president has been held by police in quite this way. But this latest development is, of course, in relation to a very specific tip of the iceberg in what is a complex string of legal cases and investigations against Mr. Sarkozy, most of them relating to suspicions about who funded his 2007 presidential campaign in France, which he won. But this week's detentions, including of his lawyer and two high-ranking judges, were over Mr. Sarkozy's relationship with these two judges, who are thought to have been updating Mr. Sarkozy about the ongoing legal proceedings, and who appear to have warned him that his phone was being tapped and provided details as to how an ongoing case about his personal diaries was going. So serious allegations about supposed attempts to pervert the course of justice in France. And whatever happens in the end, many suspect this is all hurting his chances of running for party leadership again later this year, and eventually if he wants to run for president in 3 years' time as well.
Sandra Gatzman in Brussels. Now, after more than three decades since their last live show, the cast of Monty Python, the British comedy troupe, are holding their opening comeback show in London this evening. Monty Python Live, mostly, is the comedy group's first reunion since 1980, with a lineup reportedly featuring new material alongside some of their most loved work brought onto stage for the first time. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead reports.
Well, she turned me into a newt. A newt. I got better.
Now, you listen here. He's not the Messiah. He's a very naughty boy.
For surreal and silly comedy lovers the world over, Monty Python's outrageous brand of humour has garnered gasps and guffaws from fans for decades. Now old and slightly more wrinkly, the farcical masters John Cleese, Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Eric Idle, Terry Gilliam and Carol Cleveland have reunited for the first time in more than three decades with an on-stage show. Eric Idle is directing the performance and spoke at a news conference about what they've been concocting.
A little comedy, a lot of pathos, yes, yeah. Some music and a tiny bit of ancient sex.
And some...
Tickets for the opening night on July the 1st sold out in just 43 seconds. Showbiz journalist Kevin Hughes says that's down to the group's huge popularity, but worries if they still have that comedy magic.
I mean, we're talking the comedy Beatles, we're talking legends, we're talking icons. We've waited a long time for this moment. I just hope that they still have the edge. I just hope they can recapture the magic that they had 30, 40 years ago, and that they haven't lost that edge. I always worry that some of these artists, because they're now establishment and they've made their money, will have lost their credibility.
Much to the delight of fans who couldn't get hold of tickets, it was announced that the final three-hour show on July the 20th will be broadcast live on the UK satellite channel Gold. Their last live performance was at the Hollywood Bowl in 1980. Since then, Graham Chapman, who played the spoof Jesus Brian in Monty Python's Life of Brian, died in 1989. But the remaining Pythons have promised he won't be absent from the new show. And how do the others still get on? John Cleese and Terry Gilliam.
We just laugh a lot when we're together, and we always have.
I mean, we laugh more. I think when we have dinner together, we laugh more than we do at any other time of our lives.
When we're separate, we don't really like each other, so it's very hard to get together. But then when we do, it's rather surprising that we may not like each other, but suddenly we're very funny together.
With shows throughout July, the crew that brought you everything from the Lumberjack song...
I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night, I work all day.
He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
Through to Spam...
Spam, egg, spam, spam, bacon and spam. Spam, 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 egg and spam. Spam, 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 bacon, spam, spam, spam and spam.
To the Spanish Inquisition...
I don't know. Mr. Wentworth just told me to come in here and say that there was trouble at the mill, that's all. I didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Are hoping modestly, in their own words, to see if they're still funny. So, in the words of Monty Python's infamous 1975 film, The Holy Grail...
Done with it.
Yes, get on with it.
Get on with it.
Dan Whitehead, London.
And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight. And with that, here's Simon Marks.
Today on FSN Spotlight, what's in a gift? Last year, the press corps covering the so-called Sunnylands Summit between President Obama and President Xi Jinping were somewhat nonplussed to learn that the US had bestowed on the Chinese leader an inscribed Redwood Park bench as a parting gift. The two men had briefly sat on it during their summit in the California desert. What were we all to make of it? And how on earth did the Chinese get it home? Two intractable questions about a summit that remains somewhat Confucian, even with the benefit of hindsight. So when China's Premier Li Keqiang visited London last week, there was enormous interest in the gift that the British government presented him. The Financial Times arts correspondent Peter Aspden takes it from there.
Keen diplomatic observers will have noted and analysed the geopolitical ramifications of David Cameron's present to Li Keqiang during the Chinese Premier's recent visit to London. The widely publicised gift, a shooting script of the first episode of Downton Abbey, signed by the show's creator Julian Fellowes, was rich in subtext. It is, I suppose, just about possible that Li is simply a fan of the programme. But that seems preposterous. This is politics. There was some kind of power game going on, have no doubt about that. Here's what may have been intended. First, the simplest scenario. Cameron was proudly showing Li how life was during the final years of the golden age of the British Empire. All that gentility, those plush interiors, that hegemonic drive. Intimidation through costume drama, soft power at its finest. But hold on to your teacups. We learn that it was Li, in fact, who expressed his admiration for the series and even wished to visit its Hampshire location, Highclere Castle. How devilishly clever. A softly powerful serve returned with stinging topspin. This, Li says as he receives the epochal document from Cameron, is what you used to have. This was the high point of British life. How far you have fallen. Now you huddle around your television sets to watch Britain's Got Talent. How does that feel? Li will doubtless have seen the most recent episode of the series, set in 1923. Guess what's coming up in 3 years' time? The general strike, that's what. It was all downhill from there. But Cameron has followed his softly powerful serve with a neat volley. Yes, Britain used to be this great. It was good to have an empire, but you know what? All empires flounder. You may be feeling the rush of power right now and feel you can do anything you want. Enter stage left, fleeting reference to human rights. But don't for one moment think it's easy or that it's going to last. This, I think, was Cameron's hidden message. But he might have gone further. Downton Abbey is all very well, but he could have really stretched the point of imperial decline with some further well-chosen gifts. The Prime Minister, steeped in popular culture, or at least Dark Side of the Moon, missed an opportunity. But here are some ideas for that perfect downer of a present for the future, the dark side of British culture. Number 1. Free tickets for the Monty Python's Flying Circus reunion at the O2, Monty Python Live, mostly, opening this week. Can there be anything more dispiriting than a bunch of aging surrealists, especially when they joke about only getting back together for the money, when it is clear they are, mostly, only getting back together for the money? Is there nobody young and funny and hungry left in the country? Number two, free tickets to see a British film. Of course, British technicians and actors are admired the world over. But the general intention of British movies is to make us depressed. We know this because every few months there's an article in the press headlined, British films are depressing. The latest was by the actor Toby Stevens, writing in March, we need to stop trying to do the same movies over and over, the gangsters and football violence, he said. Not to mention the kitchen sink realism, the homely working class comedies, Hearts of Gold, Bad Taste in Wallpaper, and the upper class twit farces. A personal favourite of mine is Rita, Sue and Bob 2, the ugliest film of all time. Number three, the CD, or better still the DVD, of Let It Be, the Beatles' final album. This marked the terminal decline of Britain's last golden cultural age. Mop tops mired in mutual contempt, antsy arguments, bad songs. Pop music, after one or two sleepy detours, see Dark Side of the Moon, never recovered. Number four, free tickets to a VVIP preview of any art fair. Watch the hyper-rich eschew the joys of handbag shopping for an hour or two and spend millions on paintings of dots instead. Watch out, Premier Lee, it's coming your way, faster than you think. Number five, an original manuscript of a devastating rock lyric. This week, the handwritten words to Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone sold for more than $2 million at Sotheby's. The song is a succinct snapshot of life in the Western world. Now you don't talk so loud, now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. But the British can do better. Here's a coruscating analysis of social immobility. All that rugby puts hairs on your chest. What chance have you got against a tie and a crest? That's from the Jam's Eton Rifles, a personal favourite of the Prime Minister, and why wouldn't it be? In the Global Times, a Chinese tabloid affiliated to the People's Daily, readers were urged, in the wake of Lee's visit, to take pity on the old declining empire that is Great Britain. Britain's national strength cannot be placed in the same rank as China now, it thundered, a truth difficult to accept for some Britons who want to stress their nobility. You see, Mr. Cameron, they fell for it. Lee Ke-chang, in the meantime, may be having deeper thoughts. Do I really want to have an empire at all?
Thought you were smart when you took them on, but you didn't take a peep in their artillery room. All that rugby puts hairs on your chest. What chance have you got against a tie and a crest?
That's Peter Aspden of the Financial Times, and you can read his arts coverage daily in the newspaper and online at ft.com. And that's Tuesday's edition of FSN Reports. Remember, you can contact us by emailing us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. Coming up on Wednesday, we take a lungful of Mexican air and discover why it's getting a great deal cleaner.
We're at the top of one of the buildings that are the offices of the Environment Department, Secretary of Mexico City. And we have green roof here. It's open to all the people that works here. In this building, we have the air quality direction. So they are doing all the analysis about the air quality and monitoring of the whole city. We're actually in downtown, and it's like a lot of cars passing around all the time.
I think we can hear those.
Yeah. So this space, it's like being away from that.
That's Wednesday, but for now I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside Simon Marks on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.